I fear that I'm going to burn through this tiny bit of white chalk, and everything else is going to be colored chalk after this. Okay, very good. There's. I have to, you know, further question my color vision. good. So, what we. Try to be responsible. Start a timer.
You'll be on.
So what we had done last time, I had kind of gotten partway through this model of thinking about, in the specific case of an axion dark matter search, maybe a little more generally, an ultralight dark matter search where the laboratory apparatus is some high Q oscillator that we want to couple to infer the presence of some dark matter signal from the motion of that oscillator, but maybe a little more specifically, again, in the context of a QCD axion search, truly the harmonic oscillator is a microwave cavity, and that's what this cylinder is supposed to represent. I was encouraging the picture that represents in a very intentional way the noise and loss associated with punching a hole in that cylinder and letting fields enter and leave. And that's going to encode essentially the signal that you try to measure and the back action, the associated noise that's introduced by measuring it. And so we wrote down Heisenberg-Langevin equations of motion in the rotating frame of the cavity's frequency, the evolution in the sort of Heisenberg picture of that cavity and then the associated field that comes out of the cavity into a transmission line. The awkward silence as I turn my back to all of you and write on the board. Okay. I won't box those yet, so let's. We'll think of the decay rate out of this cavity happening at energy decay rate happening at some rate kappa m. And for the time being, that's the only source of dissipation our cavity has. And that's why this total dissipation rate at the moment is just kappa m. What I want to encourage you to think about, really think of an experiment like this, just I'll finish the sentence and think of an experiment like this as a little bit like a scattering experiment. You're imagining that in each instant in time, there's a little packet of electromagnetic energy, or perhaps just vacuum, incident on the cavity, interacts with it, is perhaps transformed by the action of the cavity, and then gets measured. And we're going to infer everything about the state of the cavity from this field that comes out. Yes, go ahead.
So in the second equation here, the you know, the second equation, the B out, yeah.
This expression?
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to understand why it's zeroth order in time derivatives. And so I think what this is saying is, like, everything that goes on the in mode also reflects back on the out mode, but you also have some leakage from the cavity. Why isn't there some kind of reflection coefficient in front of B in M?
This question got asked after the lecture last time. If we were going to model it as having many modes, and indeed cavities can, in particular, like if where our kind of fields were maybe associated with an optical cavity, and there were some round trip time inside of the cavity, you could well imagine that there would be a lot of like internal dynamics. In our current picture, there's just one degree of freedom in there. It's just one harmonic oscillator. And in that approximation, yeah, we can really think about this as essentially instantaneous. If the rate kappa is small compared to the spacing between modes, if you like the free spectral range of a cavity, and I just want to build my world around one degree of freedom, then this kind of just treating it as this sort of instantaneous in time thing is going to end up being the same level of approximation as saying this is Markovian. So what you'd like to, like, I think what you're asking me is, shouldn't I have like a partial reflection and partial transmission, and then there would be some evolution inside of the cavity before the field starts to come out, and there would be an explicit time delay associated with that?
Or even should really in front of this B in M, should there be like a one minus kappa, and then you're just saying kappa is very small, so I'm approximating that as one or something like that?
Well, okay, so it's not exactly kappa, but yes, there's, you could imagine saying there's a one minus a small thing, it is like kappa is derived from that small thing, but it is not exactly equal to that. So one minus kappa would be dimensionful, for example.
Sure. So there's a very weak link between these two is basically what
they are explicitly assumed to be kind of weakly coupled enough that I can think of them separately. And then when I imagine they're coupled, that I don't make profound changes to the eigenmodes of either. And that so I just get this one little kind of instantaneous in time interaction.
Thank you.
Did you want to be in front of the kappa over two there?
I do. Thank you. That's what I figured the question was originally. I said, oh, I've left something out of the equation. And I did get a minus sign out front. Good. Minus sign's important. Things should decay. Good. So I'm encouraging this notion that the way to think about this is you have fields that scatter off of the cavity are modified and then measured, and you learn things about the cavity from that scattering. So what we haven't said anything about are the statistical properties of those fields, but this resistor, thanks to our lecture earlier today, which was in mechanical domain, but it's really, the physics actually doesn't care that much about whether you think of them as electrical or mechanical variables. If you have dissipation, you should imagine there are fluctuations associated with that. And in fact, we're going to make a model of the fluctuations sourced by that resistor, provided in a sense by that resistor, whose only job it is to guarantee that the statistical properties of this cavity and of the electromagnetic modes in this cavity is just sort of obey the statistical properties that we would expect for our harmonic oscillators at some temperature. So in particular, if we say, look, this resistor is at some temperature T, what I would like to be true is that the number of photons on average inside of that cavity should follow some just simple Boltzmann law or Stefan Boltzmann law. And consequently, from commutation relations of these bosonic creation and annihilation operators, this quantity will, let's see, no, that's right. So, you know, when I refer to quantum noise, when quantum noise is referred to generally, you should really think of it as just somehow being something associated with the fact that the quantities that we use to describe the state of some physical system quantum mechanically don't commute. And any kind of terms that sort of start appearing from those commutation relations usually associate that with quantum noise. So how shall we choose the statistical properties of these input fields to guarantee that this is true? Not a derivation, just an argument that says, look, I didn't write in my time variables. All right, maybe I'll fix that defect. So, so this expression, I've sort of been a bit explicit here. This kind of like thermal average number of photons in the cavity. You know, this is not generally true for the input modes that they would always have the thermal average number of photons. If you remember, this is written in a rotating frame at frequency omega c, and for regions of frequency narrow, you know, sort of centered around that central frequency, we can think of the statistical properties of these input fields as just being sort of approximately at the center frequency of the cavity. They are frequency dependent quantities, or rather the noise average number of photons depends on whether we're looking at 1 gigahertz or 10 gigahertz, but we're just fixing the range of frequencies we're looking at to be close to the cavity's frequency. So this is kind of a close to resonance high Q approximation. But that, and then we can write down also the properties of we can also write down the same properties in frequency, thinking of frequency as the label of our operators, so they're kind of the Fourier transform values. So again, these frequencies are with respect to a rotating frame at omega c. In other words, if my cavity is 5 gigahertz and omega might be 10 kilohertz above or 10 kilohertz below that frequency. But yeah, we'll think of the statistical properties, the average values, as being governed by this thermal occupancy close to the cavity's resonance frequency. And I'm missing a 2 pi because, you know, because Fourier transform. That one doesn't have the 2 pi. You get the 2 pi. All right. And again, if I were to invert the order of the operators, you know, I'd get a plus 1 for each one of these terms. Okay. So this is, of course, in a world where we would be perfect. Our cavity would have no loss, no absorption. We would like to be able to model its imperfection. I think, as we said in the last lecture, I can imagine doing that by introducing a kind of fictitious transmission line. Maybe I'll imagine, and all I want to do is arrange for the loss rate that I know that the cavity has. It's going to lose energy over time. That rate that it loses energy intrinsically, maybe kappa L, I will model that as if it's a transmission line that's coupled to my cavity that extracts energy out at rate kappa L. And then the cavity, presumably its loss is associated with its physical temperature. It's going to be in the axion search experiment, typically sitting inside of a dilution refrigerator, maybe not quite as cold as one wishes it would be. And that's really going to be the physical temperature of that object. And the statistical properties will be determined entirely by this simple picture. And we can then modify our equations of motion in the way that you'd expect. It will be a new field that couples associated with that port. And now the loss rate is not kappa m anymore. It's the sum of kappa m and kappa l. And in general, all of the kappas, all of the loss rates, will just add up to give us a total quantity that we'll call kappa, the total loss rate of the cavity. Doesn't matter where it loses energy to, it loses energy at some total rate, that's kappa. And then finally, I feel like I've scrunched my diagram awkwardly. Add in the axion coupling, and it's a minus. And now we have a complete model for decay of the cavity, back action associated with measurement, decoherence that I wish wasn't there but can't get rid of because I'm not perfect, and signal. All treated on the same footing, all look the same in my equations. No strange little ad hoc claims of mysterious quantum angels causing decoherence. It's just there, right? It's just this term. Maybe they're quantum demons, right? Let's see. at this point, I would like to flee for the familiar comfort of the frequency domain. Take a Fourier transform this equation and start sort of just doing simple algebra. But before I do that, I'll answer the question.
Yeah.
Which term did I leave out?
Oh, no, I was just...
Where's the error?
There's no error that I can tell. I just wanted to ask. So this morning, Nina drew a picture of it for us of a harmonic oscillator with some damping, and it was being monitored by a laser. Am I correct in understanding an analogy? So the cavity is the harmonic oscillator, the damping is the loss, and then the monitoring by the laser is everything that's going on with the B in and B out, or?
There can be modifications to the story I'm telling depending on details. Mm-hmm. There's no a laser would have some sort of active energy input
I guess I'm talking at a very high level. Like, yeah,
but it's a high level, that's right.
A way to monitor it, to monitor its displacement.
You know, if I'm monitoring the position of an object and I didn't do a perfect job of making it an infinite queue, then there would be some term kind of analogous to this one that would describe that. And then my laser is monitoring the position. It's sort of monitoring some coordinate. There will be kind of a back action like term associated with that.
Right. So the laser stuff would be lumped into the back action, like
the
M elements.
Okay. That's right. It's possible I didn't stay for the lecture. I was maybe more preparing these notes. So I will just admit that at this time. Go ahead.
So if I look at the kind of intrinsic losses you're talking about, this kappa L.
Pardon?
If I look at the intrinsic losses that you're talking about, the kappa L?
Yes.
Okay. Where is temperature entering? Is kappa L dependent on temperature, or is B in L? I mean, B in L clearly depends on temperature, because that's going to have some expectation value, but
yeah.
Does kappa L also depend on temperature?
Well, who knows the physical phenomena that might be associated, but usually not. So meaning the following thing. The rate at which, let's take the particular case of an axion search using a copper cavity. The dissipation rate, the loss rate you wish wasn't there, is not very temperature dependent at low temperatures. And there's certainly no kind of like fundamental calculation that one does in this context to say kappa L must be associated with that loss. But, you know, these kind of expressions here where these funny square roots appear in here, and the sort of the way the decay rate enters and so on, those are cooked up. They're derived, but they're derived in such a way where if they didn't give you what you expected from the fluctuation dissipation theorem, you would say you made a mistake. There is no fundamental reason why this must be temperature dependent in this kind of description. Where does temperature enter? From the statistical properties of those input fields. That's right.
And similarly for the axion field here?
Say again?
Similarly for the axion field, kappa A is what I would say is proportional to like the coupling constant,
yeah,
A, gamma,
all of
gamma
the
or something.
Physics associated with how does dark matter couple to my cavity, the thing that I really, really, really can't calculate, that's hiding in there. It's also hiding inside of the amplitude of this generator. You might think that's just the dark matter density. Turns out in this representation, you sort of have to put a bit of the coupling into both places.
Okay. And then B in is a B in axion is a non-thermal distribution. That's the axion background distribution.
Okay. We're going to, because the derivation won't depend in any important way, we won't make too many bones about exactly what the statistical properties of this thing is. But you should imagine that it is describing a narrow Q of a million signal at some frequency you don't know. That's right. Absolutely right. Good. So I'm going to get rid of my statistical properties and my equation of motion and just keep my cavity. And what I'm going to do is write down the Let's see, how efficient do I want to be? It says 2 p.m. It says it's really 2 p.m. That means I've been going for about 25 minutes. Yeah, okay. Let's be efficient then. If I were to solve the equation that I just erased by going to the frequency domain and doing algebra, there's a very compact way to write the frequency dependent or the frequency domain scattering of those input fields to output fields. And I'm going to imagine the thing which I haven't really done so far is try to represent the output fields leaving to these kind of fictitious ports that I've drawn. But they're, you know, they're calculable in exactly the same way. So I'm going to introduce just an index J for the moment and say there's going to be some susceptibility like matrix chi j k, k an index. And then somewhat overly compact notation. J and K are indices. They take on values in my notation. They're elements of either M for the measurement port, L for the loss port, A for the axion port. And so you can see that the measurement port is no one going to complain that I left a sum out. No one, it's like Lehner 2 left out the sum. Maybe I'm using Einstein summation notation, right? And that's what everyone thought? Yeah, okay, fair enough. That's what I was doing. But. Frequency domain output fields, frequency domain input fields, frequency dependent susceptibilities that take on this form. It does. It's precisely what has happened. We took the time evolution, time domain Heisenberg-Lonergan equation of motion for the cavity. And then the output field and combine those together to eliminate the cavity. So this is really a picture now of how input fields are transformed to output fields at each Fourier frequency close to cavity resonance. The cavity disappears from the picture, right? Well, I haven't said anything about measurement yet. Measurement, if you recall from the very beginning of the lecture yesterday, that's usually where the noise was sort of hidden. That was sort of like the claim was that was the source of the noise in these measurements. And it's sort of like you couldn't get a perfect enough triangle, you got the best one you could, and it came so close to some supposed quantum limit, and that was sort of the end of the story. So these quantities, these annihilation operators, they're not per se measurable in the sense that they're not, you know, Hermitian observables. But any equations that describe the evolution of these also describe the evolution of the creation operators. And so you can make linear combinations. Which are observable. Are physically detectable, measurable things. This is one of two orthogonal linear combinations. The other one, you know, it's got the minus sign, usually written with the imaginary constant down in the denominator, and called y. These are, in frequency domain, the quadrature observables. They represent, if you like, if you're at some frequency centered, if you remember at the cavity's resonance frequency, they represent essentially fluctuations or signal any variation which would be either in phase or 90 degrees out of phase with some clock in your lab which would be running at the cavity's resonance frequency. There's some arbitrariness in the choice of which is X and which is Y associated with the fact that, you know, the clock in your lab has a kind of a starting time which is just sort of arbitrary. But that this quantity you can measure without introducing any noise. That is, there's no property of quantum mechanics per se that, you know, limits the knowledge of a single dynamical variable. But only in sort of pairs of dynamical variables that don't commute. So there is indeed a quantity y, which would be the, and it is the case that. Oh. I have to remember to put the arguments in. I'm going to actually put in the delta functions. It used to be the case that you could not acquire an object that in an electrical context just measured this noiselessly. That is not the case anymore. It's kind of a routine thing now. So there's no more sense in which you're forced to add noise here. If you choose to measure just X or just Y, you don't have to add noise. Is there noise? Yes. Where did it come from? Well, here or here, but not necessarily there. Go ahead, Mira.
Yeah. So can you give us a bit of intuition about what X hat is, what you actually measure? Because from B hat and B dagger B, we get to be the creation and annihilation operators of modes in the cavity. What, in that sense, I know it's like a generalized position operator of sorts, but the question is, what do you physically measure when you measure that quadrature?
Like, so,
yeah.
Maybe this, like, it is my regret that probably the relevant context is more in the optical domain rather than in the electrical domain. Okay. But if we were talking about optical fields, what you would have is the field that you would be interested in measuring, and you would combine that on, forgive me, a beam splitter, with an intense laser light field where the beam splitter would be very asymmetric, not in a practical sense, but just the way we'll describe it, where the intense field, you would throw away most of that, but that's fine, it's gigantic anyway. And then that would then fall on a photodiode that would measure the intensity. The fluctuations of the field that you're interested in measuring that are in phase with the great big sine wave, you would usually call X. The in-phase component.
Is it like a phase measurement?
It does not directly measure the phase, but it is, in a sense, phase sensitive, in the sense that if you changed the phase of your laser, you would then measure the intensity fluctuations of the orthogonal quadrature. And in that sense, it's a phase sensitive measurement. Go ahead.
I guess also thinking a bit in the optical domain, I could imagine that such a cavity could have multiple modes. And since your commutator allows the different modes to be measured at the same time, can you do such a thing in an experiment?
Yeah. So at the moment, the story so far has really just been building the world around one mode. This generalizes in a pretty nice way to multiple modes. If you were clever and you could arrange for, say, two modes inside of the cavity and to control the joint quantum state of those two modes, you could prepare them in states where their particular linear combinations of the kind of quadrature operators that we're talking about here in the two modes that actually do commute. For example, if your dark matter coupled to one of these modes, but you managed to prepare the two modes in some state that was like an eigenstate of these joint operators, then you could measure the thing that no one has asked me about yet, both quadratures of the kind of incoming axion field noiselessly. So there's no, but at the moment I hadn't planned to get to that. That would be like in the fourth lecture I would give. There are definitely utility to multiple modes. If you saw Liz Ruddy's poster, you had some flavor of working with multiple modes. All right.
So sorry, one other question.
Please.
So this is really a dumb, but I'm just trying to understand this measurement, this kind of non-demolition measurement you were talking about, just X or just Y.
So just to be clear, measuring just X or just Y, I'm not sure that I'm ready to call that a non-demolition measurement, at least within the context of what I would think I would mean by that, but go ahead.
So let me just take the output port from this cavity.
Output port of the cavity, yeah. Good.
And now let me take that, split it into two beams.
Good.
Put a beam splitter and then try to measure one of them the X and one of them the Y.
So I love it. Yes.
Where does the noise get introduced when I do this?
At the beam splitter, at the open part of the beam splitter. Great question. All right. Imagine that I had a box that measured X and a box that measured Y. Huh? And then all I want to do is take this output field and split it. All right. I'm going to use optic symbols because what else am I going to do, right? Mm-hmm. All right. There's my box that measures X. There's my box that measures Y. Here's the, nope, not that way. You can tell, should never let experimentalists who don't work in optics draw beam splitters. There we go. There's my output field, be out coming into that point. Part goes down to, one over square root of two of the amplitude goes that way. One over square root of two of the amplitude goes that way. And at a minimum, a pure quantum state, which might be vacuum, enters there. And what I will measure at X is a linear combination of this port and that port. I will do a noiseless job of that, but I didn't want to learn anything about this. This is not interesting to me. This is not signal. It is fluctuations that I don't care about. I refer to it pejoratively as noise. I will measure an orthogonal linear combination of these two. Again, I care about that thing. I learn about some linear combination of the two.
So when B out is large compared to the vacuum, I can measure both just fine, but that's just the same statement as, you know, if this is a very large classical signal, I can measure, you know, the two quadratures just fine.
You know, as a matter of, you know, to be precise, if you put in a laser and you say, well, I want to determine kind of the noise and its quadrature amplitudes, if you make an inference by doing this measurement for a long time of what the noise in kind of the X quadrature is on top of a great big classical sine wave, but you'll see some fuzz on top of that. And then you measure the Y quadrature and you see some fuzz and you say, what like two-dimensional fuzzy blob do I associate with that? And I look at that area. If I try to measure both simultaneously, I will double that area. I will add one vacuum's worth of noise. Exactly.
Thank you.
I didn't even think I was going to get to that. This is fabulous. Thank you for asking. All right. So let me clean up my board just a little bit. So what we can write down are statistical properties of that X quadrature that we might choose to measure. And we can think of them, you know, the frequency content in those statistical fluctuations. Lose that. Lose my commutation relation. So my kind of frequency domain correlator my X's seem to have changed font. More or less, you know, you're going to get a delta function. If you're talking about the fluctuations at different frequencies, they will be uncorrelated. If you're talking about the fluctuations at the same frequency, if we were living in a world of finite time, you know, it would be some number because it's infinitesimal in frequency and infinite in time, we'll have the Dirac delta function. This quantity is usually what you think of as the spectral density. And that you could just follow through all of the definitions, and SX out so much board management regret right now. All right, we can lose our overly large susceptibility, and we'll write out. That spectral density will just be our susceptibility elements squared times the statistical fluctuations associated with each of the ports to our cavity. I haven't said much about what statistical properties we should imagine, you know, describe the axion field. We should think of some sharply peaked function with lots of energy in it, but you don't know the frequency. Go ahead. These ends here, this end. Here? Oh, that's M for measurement port. So that is the magnitude squared of the scattering from this port in to this port out, the measurement port in, measurement port out. This is measurement port out, loss port in, measurement port out, axion port in. Yeah. So if we were to graph the spectral density that we would measure as a function of frequency and really think about these three different contributions. These two have kind of very similar character. To me, microwave engineer that I am, that's sort of obvious when I look at this picture, because the frequency content and whatever is coming into the cavity from this port or from this port, they're processed, they pass through the same cavity, they follow the same path to the amplifier. At each frequency, no matter how far on or off resonance, no matter whether I'm strongly coupled at this port or weakly coupled, they will stay in the same ratio. The thing which is different, the thing which will depend on whether or not I, the thing which will, so essentially the frequency content inside of these two terms will look the same. The dependence on this coupling strength will look the same. The thing which will look different than those is this term here, because that's sourced from here. It takes a different path. So I'm going to attempt to graph those terms, specifically this term here, this term here, this term here. This is probably zero. You know, whether or not you believe the Pesci-Quinn mechanism and so on, at any frequency you're likely to have tuned your cavity to, it's probably going to be zero. But what we'll do is we'll just say, what could it be? We'll think, well, maybe there's some generator, maybe this, I'll think of this as just being some broadband noise source that I'm hoping to measure. And then I can at least look at how it depends on frequency. And if I do that, I make the following assumptions. Kappa A, that's just going to be, I wish this weren't true, but it's always going to be true. My coupling of my axion field to my cavity, it's never going to be the dominant source of loss. It's never even going to be like a meaningful contribution. Your hope of detecting the axion by watching photons disappear and turning into dark matter is not very good. And then we're going to make the choice to do that. If you make that choice, fortunately, so we will plot log of omega. We'll plot and then log of some n times chi mj squared. So, and then here we'll mark I'll refer to these as terms M, L, and A. So the frequency content in my loss port and in my axion port that arrives at my measurement as a function of frequency, those are in fixed proportion at any frequency. And furthermore, if you make this choice, the ratio is as big as it'll ever be. Meaning that if you optimize over how strongly you couple your measurement to your cavity, the ratio that you'll achieve is maximized when these two things are equal. When you make the measurement and loss rate equal. So when you look at this, it becomes apparent that there's not much you can do about this source of noise. Well, you could make your cavity colder, and you should do that. You could make it less lossy, and you should do that. You could improve the signal-to-noise ratio by buying a bigger magnet, and that would make this come up. But what you can't do is kind of manipulate the quantum state of anything here, because those, like what you mean by it when you say that's loss, is that's something that I don't have access to. I can change its temperature, but I can't control the quantum state of that resistor. That's not true here. That's a real thing that you can just pick up and hold in your hand. And you can do something about that. And in particular, so what you, the game you would like to play is to preserve over as wide a range in frequency this very terrible signal way down here, noise way up there, that terrible signal to noise ratio, over as wide a range as you can. And right now, you're sort of not paying much penalty from this source of noise when you're at low frequencies down near your cavity's resonance frequency. But as you move out past your cavity's bandwidth, what's happening is all of the noise sourced from here is bouncing essentially unabsorbed, untransformed in magnitude off of your cavity reaching your amplifier. Even though, so if you look at this, these sum in this approximation, these two terms where I'm ignoring the dissipation here, they sum to one. These two temperature sources are the same. The noise that reaches your amplifier doesn't depend on frequency. It is frequency independent. But it has very different origins. Close to resonance, it's coming from the absorption of your cavity, from its sort of intrinsic decoherence and loss. Off resonance, it comes from all the stuff that's reflected off of the cavity that you drive, you try to drive in off resonance. So the game that you would like to play is figuring out how you get rid of that. That's something that you can do not by buying a bigger magnet, being lucky enough to live in a part of the universe that has higher dark matter density, but by just sort of changing the way you do the experiment. And what you change is you modify the quantum statistics of this thing in a particular way. So if we ask, good. All right.
Yeah.
I have, according to my thing, four and a half more minutes. All right, good. So the fact that X and Y don't commute, that tells you that in some sense you cannot measure both of them in some noiseless way. You know, that's there. The structure of quantum mechanics is incompatible with having a simultaneous eigenstate of those two quantities. But so let's reflect it in the fact that if you said, oh, I have a little triangle, and the role of my triangle is to multiply things by a letter G called the gain, and I'll think of that as measurement because if I amplify a signal coming in and then I hand it off to something else that does something else to it, and that something else adds noise, I get to not worry so much about the noise added further downstream because whatever noise was present at the input has now been amplified, and therefore whatever is added afterwards is more negligible. That's essentially amplification as measurement in a nutshell. If I imagine that I'm going to be a little bit X out and Y out, what I imagine that they're sort of present at the input here, and I'll imagine that they're sort of primed values or what's at the output. I'll be a little bit schematic without worrying about all the delta functions. If we just said, oh, I'm going to multiply X by G and Y by G, what that would imply if I could do that? Is that I would get G times X here and G times Y here, and I would have, the fact that I didn't preserve commutation relations just, you know, guarantees for me without much calculation that there's something, this cannot be a unitary process. I expanded volume in phase space in direct violation of Liouville's theorem. But if my G did something different than just multiplying X by G and Y by G, if what it did was made X prime out equal to G times X out and Y prime out equal to 1 over G. That you can do noiselessly, right? I plug that into commutation relations. The input and output commutation relations are preserved. That could be a unitary process. So, to sum up my lecture, if you can measure noiselessly by making an amplifier that does this thing, well, you might as well take that same amplifier and put it here. Take a second copy. And use it to squeeze, yes, the X quadrature. And then measure the X quadrature, meaning amplify the X quadrature at the output. And in that way, you get to drive this piece down. That's it. So this is an example of quantum enhanced measurement. We take advantage of the fact that our axion field really is incredibly weakly coupled. We wish we could couple more strongly, but we can't. It's kind of a classical force pushing on our harmonic oscillator. Nothing in principle prevents us from measuring with arbitrary precision the value of some classical force. It's going to enter our Hamiltonian as some number, some parameter. We're doing parameter estimation. And our choice of preparing this in, say, a vacuum state or a thermal state, and then measuring one quadrature, that's a choice which is less optimum than preparing this input field in a squeezed state, squeezed vacuum, squeezed thermal state, either way. Okay, that's what I wanted to tell you.
Cool, more questions?
Hello, this was super helpful. On this plotintron, where does omega C lie? Where does the cavity frequency lie?
Sorry, say that again?
On your plot of log omega, log n, where does the cavity frequency lie on this plot?
Basically, if you remember, omega is frequency units detuned from, and sorry, the cavity frequency is infinitely far that way because it's a log scale and that would be zero, but yeah.
So why? Is it obvious that I should have complete reflection both far above the cavity frequency and also far below the cavity frequency? I might have expected that like a signal that's very DC might look very different from a signal that's very AC.
So the signals are always AC in the sense that they're always in frequency to the drive frequency. For things that are right on resonance, the reflection, this is M. I seem to have lost my M, but actually the reflection is small on resonance because we made this choice.
Right, right. I mean, because you're plotting omega minus omega C, I assume it's the absolute value of omega minus omega C.
It is the... when we went to this quadrature picture, frequencies became only positive numbers in this representation, but that's okay. What is surprising to you here? This is the reflection off of the cavity. Right on resonance, because it's so-called critically coupled, all of the input field will be absorbed in the cavity. And as we move off resonance, it's all reflected. Is that essentially the question?
I think I'm asking a different question. And I'm happy to delay until afterwards.
No, but like right now, you seem to be super engaged, and I love that. So let's stick with it.
So my question is, let me take a really slow variance. So like a signal that's varying very slowly, a noise signal that's varying very slowly.
Yes.
So that is at an omega that is far lower than the cavity frequency.
Far lower than the cavity frequency. Yes, it's far lower than the cavity frequency. But what you would have to say is, that would correspond to a frequency that was right at cavity resonance, and then we would be talking about very slow amplitude or phase modulation of that signal. So in other words, the omega that's appearing here in this axis, right? This is your 1 hertz above the cavity frequency, or 1 hertz above and below the cavity frequency, 2 hertz above and below. You can think of a phaser if you've been dragged through electrical engineering language, which is right at the cavity resonance, and therefore in that picture it's fixed in time, and then we're going to change the amplitude of it. And that rate of that amplitude changing, or its phase changing, that's what's happening at frequency omega.
Okay, thank you. Yep.
Can you take this?
Got it. I just have a notational question. I've always wondered why... When I draw a circuit for like circuits class, I always draw the current going to ground. why do we always have the signal coming from ground in this kind of notation?
You know, ground in some sense, what these little triangles mean is that I am defining the potential between some center conductor and some outer conductor in a transmission line. I apologize for the, you know, I'm a little culturally bound on my electrical engineering culture here. So I don't think you should think of signals flowing to or flowing away from ground so much as this is just saying that the signals that we talk about are defined as the potential difference between an inner and an outer conductor in a cable or between two wires in some transmission line. And this is simply defining this node of the circuit as being the same potential as the as this point on the outer. If you have a voltage source that can both inject current into ground and extract current out of ground. I don't know that. I think this triangle is simply saying that the fluctuations imposed by the resistor, the axion signal gets imposed between the center and the outer conductor. That's all it's really supposed to say.
Thank you.
Could be clearer about that if I kind of connected my outers like that. Or do that.
Okay, yes, yes. Thanks.
Okay, I guess. Let's thank Conrad again.